I would like to welcome you very much to the panel discussion of this morning on climate changes and energy challenges. In the preparation of this meeting, we asked the laureates if there are certain subjects which should be discussed in a panel. Very, very many responded positively and said that climate change and energy problems should be one very important subject, and so here we are. From our side, as discussion leader, we were able to convince Professor Schellenhuber to chair this panel. Thank you very much for this. Professor Schellenhuber is the head of the Institute for Climate Impact Research in Potsdam in Germany and an expert in this field. After general statements here at the podium, we try to include questions from the audience also. You have seen that you have got some pieces of paper, and please write your questions down and bring them here to the front to Mr. Zones and Lubitz. And they will prepare them, bring them up, and so we can discuss it. So we should start. Professor Schellenhuber.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. This is a very exceptional panel, as I can see. You see, it's a bit crowded up here because so many laureates were willing to take part in this discussion here. I will quickly present or remind you of the panelists. So we have on my far right Professor Michel, Hartmut Michel, Nobel laureate in chemistry. Then we have Jack Steinberger, Nobel laureate in physics. We have Professor Osharov from Stanford University, also in physics. We have Burkhard Frigge, myself, and here a surprise guest, more or less, Carlo Rubbia, who was willing to join us for the day, Nobel laureate in physics. We have Professor von Klitzing, who is well known to the German public, and not only the German public here. We have Professor Chaber, also physicist, and we have Professor Deisenhofer. So that was a very quick tour d'horizon here. Before we have some opening statements of 3 minutes or so by all the panelists, let me make a few remarks on the overall issue. Global warming, man-made climatic change, so I emphasize man-made climatic change, has been a very hot topic last year in 2007, you know, and this was in a sense honored or acknowledged by awarding the Peace Nobel Prize to the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I have been a convening lead author of IPCC, so in a sense it's interesting that a scientific assessment was awarded a Peace Nobel Prize and not a Nobel Prize in physics or whatever. Anyway, here we are. Now, the IPCC did a very painstaking analysis of almost every aspect. 3,000 scientists are involved in general about really every issue related to climatic change, so turning every stone. So a scientific consensus has emerged that there is a problem. Climate is changing, humanity is involved, but the degree of the extent of global warming we will see during this century is still a matter of debate, clearly. Yeah? Some people think it's just half a degree globally. Others think it will be more than 5 or 6 degrees, as, for example, is debated by and discussed by Jim Hansen from Columbia University, whom I met last week on this issue. Now, dealing with climate change means that we have 3 options, actually. The first one is called mitigation, but simply means reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The question is how much and when. The second is adapting to climate change. Humanity has always adapted to changing environmental conditions. So can we do this on a planetary scale? That's the question. With 9 billion people living on this planet by 2050 or so on. And there's a third option, which is called ignoring the problem, which is a very powerful option. Clearly, it's called business as usual. Question is, can we do it? Now, the interesting thing is that Germany was presiding the G8 and the European Union last year also. And Chancellor Merkel, who is, by the way, a theoretical physicist by training, and I have the honor to advise her on scientific issues, she tried to combine the big issues of climate change and energy security. And you know, this year We are all concerned with the energy issues, the oil prices soaring. And the question is, of course, do we have these three options also for the energy problem, in particular the last option, just ignoring the problem? And I think this option, business as usual, is not a good choice, because we will run out of fossil fuels anyway. With coal, maybe it takes 200 years, but with oil and gas, it's a much more rapid process. So if you combine the two things, and even think of the food crisis we will be embarking over the next decades, clearly, we clearly need a sort of winning set of strategic solutions. And the best thing would be if we come up with solutions which would combine climate and energy security and provide enough food for everybody on this planet. And I think this is a time, and that's my last remark, when politicians and business leaders turned to science and technology again. That was not the case in the 70s and the 80s, when if you were trained in mathematics and physics like myself and appeared on a local party, you were seen as a monster, more or less. That has changed clearly, and now there is a lot of hope which is put on scientific and technological solutions, in particular when it comes to energy efficiency, avoiding emissions by switching to renewables, nuclear power in one way or the other, and a number of other issues like, of course, energy from biomass, which is an interesting and hotly debated issue right now. And actually, we have expertise on all these issues here on the panel. That's very nice. So without much further ado, we will have some opening statements, and I picked a certain order for that, and let's see how it works. I had sort of formulated in the run-up to this sort of master questions. The first question is, and the panelists are free to ignore these questions or address them. So the first one is, how serious do you think personally is this combined challenge of climate change and energy security? So this complex, really, of sustainability issues for the centuries, as you might call it. Now, the second, what are the best combined strategies to deal with that? And the third one is, how can science and technology contribute to the solutions? In particular, will we see a new era for an intensified dialogue between science and society as driven by these planetary challenges? So this is just for orientation, and now I'd like to give the floor to the panelists. So we have actually seven active panelists here, and they have up to 3 to 5 minutes, but hopefully we will confine themselves to 3 minutes, and I would like to start with Professor Osheroff. So that's always the worst choice for the. But in particular, I would like to ask you, do you see there is a big challenge here? I mean, the combined issue of climate change and energy demand, and do you have a sort of silver bullet strategy for solving it? That's a nasty question. I acknowledge that. Please, Professor Osher.
Well, let me just state that this is actually, I mean, I've already given a talk on global warming at a Lindau meeting, which shows that I do not feign from talking about things that I know nothing about. So I will continue, therefore. But I've actually written some notes, and I thought I might use them if, in fact, I was an early speaker. And so I think that this is a very challenging problem, and I think it's a very serious one. I mean, at some level, of course, at this point, as you look at the CO2 level going up and temperatures rising, ice melting all over the world, you can say, well, is this just an aberration of our climate? And I think the answer is no. It is real, and we must have a response to it, is my feeling. And certainly, I think that the climactic changes will impact our ability to put food on the table. If you looked at the huge floods in the United States Midwest, that's an example of what we can expect to happen, I think, over and over again. I think part of the challenge is that as this as we put more CO2 in the atmosphere, at the same time, our economic engines are ever increasing in their efficiency in taking raw materials and converting them into things that we want, such as energy. And I don't see any end to that. The climate changes are difficult to predict. The responses are typically very nonlinear. And to give you a couple of examples of this, the fact that we see warming going on and melting of the Arctic ice, that melting means that more solar radiation is being absorbed by the oceans. The fact that we're melting the Arctic tundra means that we will be putting large amount, we're not putting it, but we are indirectly responsible for large amounts of methane going into the atmosphere, which is an extremely, a much more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2. So these are nonlinear effects. And if you, for instance, use as a metric our ability to quantify these things, the melting of the Greenland ice cap, that melting has always been at the very upper end of predictions of what is going to happen. And I see no reason why that won't continue. I think it is a tremendous challenge. I would say that right now, I see all sorts of problems for meeting that challenge. Certainly in the United States, a mixture of politics, as usual, I would say, with steps that must be taken, very complicated. Why we're using ethanol, I think, has to do with the Republican support for farm subsidies, and I don't think I have to say any more about that. But that's just one example of the tremendous complications of actually getting this. You need to get all the nations of the world to work together at a time when, in fact, there is growing demand and decreasing supplies for most of the raw materials and most of the finished materials that we need. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. I'd like to hand over to Professor Eva Cheban now, because I think we had some preliminary exchange of emails, and you may have a different take on this regarding the challenge, but maybe you can actually provide a silver bullet solution.
Well, let me say first that I did not volunteer for this panel.
So he was forced.
No.
Let me say, secondly, I'm a skeptic. I told you that yesterday. And thirdly, I am from Norway, so why should I worry?
Right.
Now, I am unfortunately becoming an old man. And I remember very well, roughly 30 years ago, we were worried about acid rain. And I was told in the United States that the Schwarzwälder had disappeared in Germany. A few years later, I went there, and by God, it was still there. Secondly, 10 years ago or so, the ozone hole was in the papers, and we're going to all die from ultraviolet radiation. But the depth of the ozone hole happened, the deepest ozone hole was in 1993. And after that, it didn't come any deeper. So then they start talking about the width of the ozone hole to scare people. Now we have gotten into global warming, and it's become a new religion. You're not supposed to be against global warming.
We'll be next.
You have basically no choice. And I tell you how many scientists support that. But the number of scientists is not important. The only thing that's important is the scientists were correct. That's the important part. And when you see the hockey stick, or whatever they call it, global warming temperature, you know, it looks sort of scary, but it's in a fraction of a degree what that is measured at. When you make a plot, you can make the plot very big, but it really isn't very big compared to the temperature we are at. And I did a little research on Google before I went on this panel. And so I don't claim to know much about the global warming, really. But I looked at Google. If you look at in United States, where they have, I think, better average records than they have on from the world, the global temperature, the temperature inside the United States for these years, the highest temperature was 1998. The second highest temperature was 1934. The third highest temperatures were 1921. And, you know, how can that be? And measuring temperature all over the world, where you go to average the space, average the time and whatnot, seemed to me like a very difficult situation. Thirdly, the temperature on the Earth is determined by the ocean. And the heat capacity of the ocean is infinitely larger than the heat capacity of the air. I recognize that the ocean doesn't get stirred up as well, but it certainly gets stirred up to maybe a few hundred meters, and still we are, the temperature of the ocean is like 1,000 times as important as the temperature of the air. And the temperature of the ocean is what sets the temperature of the Earth. So my personal opinion is that I'm not for pollution. I'm against pollution. It's a good thing to save on oil and whatnot. And even if the global warming is caused by man, we will use the oil nevertheless. There's really nothing much we can do about it, because people in China, people in India, people in the Philippines, they want to live like we do. And they want to have cars like we have cars. And the Kyoto Agreement was signed in 1990, and I look at Europe, and I don't see much change in these years where you're supposed to have done something about this already. And the third thing, the last thing I'm going to say, when you talk about global warming, say people say we've got to do something about that, we've got to make solar cells, we've got to have windmill, we've got to do all sorts of things. But we really have a way of doing this already. We have nuclear power. Nuclear power uses uranium. There's no other use for uranium than getting energy. And if you really were worried about this thing, why don't the people talk about nuclear power? That's all.
Yeah. Actually, we will talk about nuclear power, and I will hand over now to Carlo Rubbia, who has thought about that, but he has also thought about other things. So please, Carlo.
Thank you, John. I mean, your first question is, how big is the combined climate energy challenge? And I think that I heard your presentation of Yuger, and I feel that I am very concerned about this situation. The situation is really exceptional. Let me say, you gave us 5 minutes to speak. And in these 5 minutes, we should not forget that more than 1,200 new people are coming on Earth. There are 90 million every year. There are 1 billion every decade. And this effect in my lifetime, for instance, I'm not considered myself that old. In my lifetime, from the early 30s, the population of the Earth has been multiplied by four. We are now four times as many people as the way when I was born. And most importantly, the energy has been multiplied by a factor of 16. Today, the planet is burning 16 times more energy than what I did when I was a child. Will the child of today get another factor 4 in population, another factor 16 in energy available for the planet? Obviously, the answer is not. And obviously, in my view, the question of the climatic changes is inevitable. Now, fossils has been the basis of industrial revolution in the last 300 years. The change ahead of us is enormous. And it cannot be done, and this is the last point I want to underline, without science and technology. Let me tell you that the strange effect on the population of the Earth, about 10% of the people which ever lived on Earth are alive today. 10% of all the scientists which have been around for the history of mankind are today alive, and they obviously can be the kind of strength that we need in order to solve the problem of the future of the planet. And if you add to that the fact that we have a situation of communications, of globalizations, of easy contact amongst people, this enormously large mankind, which are dedicated to science, they should consider as a top priority the responsibility of fixing up the planet and fixing up an acceptable future with a reasonable amount of energy as it is required in order to stabilize the planet. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That was actually shorter than 5 minutes, but you will have time.
We have 500 people only.
Right, precisely. Yeah. The clock is ticking, of course. Now I'd like to hand over to Professor von Klitzing, who joined me for a Nobel laureates meeting in Potsdam last year, a symposium on on global sustainability, touching on climate, energy, and other issues. And I'd like to invite you to make your initial comments.
Perhaps I can even in shorter time, because Carlo Rubio pointed already out that the increase of the population is the main reason for all the changes. And we have the one-to-one relation between living standard and energy consumption. And if you extrapolate this, we have an energy crisis in the future. This is no doubt. Mm. And the climate change is just a result, and we have to live with the climate change. And we should try to reduce the outcome. We have time constants in some areas of 1,000 years. So even if you stop everything today, you have to live for a long time with these changes, and we have these changes. So we have to combine everything, and we have to really, as a scientist, point out what are the facts. And for me, it's always the sun energy. The scientists have to solve this problem to use the sun. Okay, the nuclear fusion, this will take too long time, so we will not be able to solve the problems in the next 50 years with this most important energy source. We have to think about clever ideas. And I think this auditorium is the best reason. So we are the bad guys. We are using the energies. So in a talk show, you have always bad guys. So all of them are here, bad guys. And you have the young generation to solve these problems. And you have to solve this only internationally. This is one of the problems. We have to solve this globally. And hopefully you can contribute to this. And the time constant is the most important part. How can we transfer from the present situation to the end of the century? We know, all scientists know, at the end of the century, we should have solved the problem to 90%. We should have solved the energy problem. But we need much more research. We have many, many questions still. And energy storage, there's so many open questions. So we have to invest in science and in research. And I hope this will be an outcome, because the facts are clear. And with my friend on the left, I think everyone agrees that we are disturbing nature by more than everything was happened in the past by nature itself. So mankind has changed drastically something. And we don't know whether we can run in an instability if we continue to increase the natural fluctuation of CO2 by more than a factor of 3. Normally, you relate everything to natural fluctuations. If you speak about radioactivity, we are much more sensitive in small amount what is available in nature. But in CO2, we say, okay, there's some increase, don't care about this, and we are happy if it becomes warmer in the north part of our Earth. So we should not ignore, and I hope that Nobel Prize winners, at least with the publicity, can contribute this. We are not able, even as a Nobel Prize winner, to solve the problems. This has to be done in the next 30 years. I think that will be the most critical one to have this transformation. And the energy problem is the main problem. The global warming is a product, the outcome of this, and we have to reduce the consequences, but we have to solve the energy problem.
No, thank you very much. I think the next two on my list, so Professor Deisenhofer and Professor Michel, in a sense, I think you have something to say about the potential solution of the energy problem here. So, Professor Deisenhofer, please.
First, I should point out that I'm not an expert on what I am going to talk about now, but I'm just an interested citizen, and I agree with most of the statements so far made, except that some of my neighbors to the right, but difference in opinion is one of the fundamental human rights, so no problem with that. I think that Professor von Klitzing expressed it very well. There are time constants in the development of the environment on the Earth, and there are perhaps critical points where the system of climate snaps from one state to another. Unfortunately, we don't know much about, we have no precise theories about that allows us to predict exactly what would happen. So when you listen to a real professional in climate research, the 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 message is that if we ignore the signs that we see nowadays, it may be too late, let's say 10 or 20 years from now, to act. And really, it can make no difference whatsoever what we do in 20 years. It is very important what we do now. And in that respect, it is clear that what we do now has to be proven technology. It has to be something we know how to do. It's not that we can wait for nuclear fusion or other prospects that are more in the future. We have to use what we have now. And so in that sense, I would like to express my hope that we can discuss in what sense and how much the prospects of climate change change our current view of nuclear energy. And it's clear that different European countries, for example, have very different approaches to that. Look at France and Germany, who are diametrically different on that question. The current generation or the first wave of nuclear reactors is coming of age and is ending their useful lifetime. And it would be time to now invest and investigate the possibility and perhaps invest in a new wave. And I would really like to hear what my colleagues here think about that.
So I will reserve the answer for Carlo, for example, Carlo Rubbia here. So Professor Michel, you actually have been in our previous communication, you have expressed that you would like to make initial comments on bioenergy, yeah, the question of biomass and biofuels in particular, which has been, in a sense, endorsed a few years ago, and now people have become very skeptical about it. Do you still see a sort of sustainable potential for bioenergy?
Bioenergy certainly is not any source to solve the energy crisis. I think so far we have not considered other aspects apart from climate change, from the production of carbon dioxide. And even if we don't consider the CO2 release, also methane release into the atmosphere, one general problem is that the demand for petrol increases the price. And this means that the people who have the oil get the money. And at the end, they earn the world. They own the world, and they tell us what to do. That's another very different reason why we should really save energy and consume less petrol and to keep the prices down. Simply, we don't. But this is a thing should be a consideration of the Nobel laureates in economics who are not here. Coming back to biomass, well, biomass is a product of photosynthesis, and as you have heard, we got the Nobel Prize for our photosynthesis research, and you are quite often addressed about this problem. And we have to look about the efficiency of photosynthetic energy conversion. And we in Northern Europe, we have some grass, miscanthus, we have corn, maize, and we have poplar trees. And if you look for the energy conversion there, what fraction of the sunlight's energy is actually stored in biomass, then it is an amazingly low percentage. It's less than 1%. It's about 0.7 to 0.8% of the sun's energy, which is stored in the biomass. And actually, nature has tried to improve that for 3 billion years. It did not succeed. Danger is always that you have light, you have oxygen, and a combination of that gets sunburned to the plant, destroys some protein subunits, the protein has to be repaired. There's no way to reproduce this process in a technological manner. And at the end, when you look for subsequent conversions in biofuel production, then you are in the range of, with German biodiesel, it's 0.08%. And if you consider the energy input, then it's 0.003% what is of the sunlight's energy in the biodiesel. And if we go for bioethanol, even Brazil, which is fortunate because they don't have to grow the sugar cane every year. They don't have to blow it every year, and they have the stems for distillation. But still there, it's only 0.2% of the sunlight's energy, which is in the bioethanol. So it's a very inefficient process. If we compare that with photovoltaic cells, which are commercially available, then we have already there a conversion energy of 15%. Another argument is here, we have in Germany, we have a so-called Energiewirt. I don't know what's in English. It's an energy farmer. A farmer who provides energy by producing biogas from corn or maize. And he gets about 0.3% energy in the biogas. But then he converts it into electric energy. He gets 0.1% of the energy. But if this guy would simply install on 1% of his farmland photovoltaic cells, he would produce more energy than via the biomass. And he could lean back because he doesn't have to work. He could spend this money, the income in Mallorca on the islands. And he wouldn't have to work for that. So this is all the nonsense of bioenergy. The other point is, it's without any doubt, there's an increase in price for food. And this hits the poorest in the world. So this is why we should clearly be against producing biofuels. The other point is, even now, if we come, the biofuel production in the tropics, in the third world countries, is much more efficient, and the cost is much lower than in Germany and Europe. So the biofuel will be produced in Indonesia. It is produced. There's the palm oil trees. And the Indonesians and the Malaysia and people from Malaysia together have already cleared the rainforest for parts of the forest which is bigger than Bavaria for producing palm oil as a biofuel for the third world. And there are two major disadvantages. One disadvantage is clearing the rainforest and the change in agriculture there then leads to a release of carbon dioxide, oxidation of peat, oxidation of organic substrate in the soil. And it takes about 400 years to refix the carbon dioxide which is released by the conversion of rainforest into palm oil industry. So there is a net loss. There is a negative effect of this biomass production, biofuel production all over the world. If we look for Brazil is bioethanol seems to be okay because it's not grown in the rainforest. It's grown in Cerrado in the savanna, but in the rainforest the big problem is their lecithin, is soybean, and the soy diesel there might have the same effect that the forest will be cleared for producing of biodiesel. So there's in the third world, there will be very bad consequences, and the clearing of the forests for producing biodiesel for Europe will be, clearly have a negative effect on the poor people, and it will have a negative effect on the climate. So we should stop this immediately.
Well, thank you very much, and in particular also for pointing out and thanks also for pointing out the orders of magnitudes. That's always a good scientific exercise to just scribble down what are the orders, and in particular your example about photovoltaic for a German farmer as opposed to biofuel production is very telling, I think. Now, finally, I will come back to that certainly, but I'd like to ask Professor Steinberger, we had some preliminary discussion also. I mean, even if we would come up with a very good solution, it has to be politically implemented, clearly. Yeah? And now global change, energy crisis is certainly a global problem, but we do not have a world government. On the other hand, we have some 200 nation states under the very weak umbrella of the United Nations. The question is, do you see a chance that we will implement in time, something like a global accord on how to deal with the problem?
So what I have to say has already been said by our chairman, so I can be quiet.
Okay, but also, maybe you have some hope for us.
Maybe I can just say two sentences. One is, I think, in large measure, the technological solutions for replacing fossil fuel use by other sources of energy, which are some of them renewable. Those exist, but they cost a certain price, and in order to implement them, it requires, this is the second sentence, the collaboration of the global governments altogether. So it requires a collaboration of the human society of our globe, and this is very difficult to achieve. Just to make one statement, when in Germany, we're here in Germany, your chancellor is a physicist, and she knows very well what the problem is, but suggest a tax for the use of carbon, which is an obvious first step in making some progress, is not something which has been strong enough to do. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. In defense of the German Chancellor, I might add, though, that this CO2 taxation for vehicles is being considered, but we have this very complicated federal system, the lender, the states, and you have to put it on the federal level. Now, thank you very much, all of you, for your introductory statements. Now, I'd like to hand over directly now to Carlo Rubbia, because how is your assessment of nuclear energy? And then I'd also like to ask you, maybe we should also focus on the solar solution, if there is any. Please, Carlo.
Well, I would like to underline that scientifically there are the possibilities to solve the problem of energy supply without CO2 in a reasonable amount of time, using technologies which are presumably available in the timetable we need, which I'm not intending to talk about fusion, which is things for tomorrow. I think there are two fundamental energies, form of energies, which are available today. One is solar energy, and the second one is the nuclear energy. But neither the solar energy nor the nuclear energy can be the energy of today. A tremendous amount of changes or inventivity or new ideas are necessary in order to make such a thing work on a planetary scale. Let me give you two factors on this. One factor is energy, solar energy. The amount of the total consumption of power of the planet corresponds to a 15,000 gigawatt supply generator. That's the average power that the mankind is using today, 15 terawatts. These 15 terawatts represent the surface of 200 times 200 square kilometers of land in a desertic, presumably isolated region in the Sun Belt. So with 200 times 200 square kilometers, we could get from the sun the same amount of energy as you get from the full fossil supply. Another way of saying that is that the amount of energy delivered by a square meter of illuminated surface of the Earth corresponds over 1 year to the rain equivalent rain of 1.5 barrels of oil. 23 centimeters of oil is the thickness of heat which we provide, if the sun is provided freely over every square meter of a sunny surface. And a collection of such a quantity, if done with systems which allow oneself to obtain these things in an efficient way, are in fact certainly a possible solutions. For this reason, a number of questions have to be raised. First of all, we need to include the developing countries into this situation. This cannot be just a source of energy for the rich ones. It has to be a source for everybody. Fortunately, most of the developing countries do have a tremendous amount of sun. And the sun technology is something which is relatively simple to develop and to construct. It doesn't need Star Wars or other complicated systems. It can be done with very bicycle-like type of approaches. I think this is one important point. The real key element in this solar energy, in my view, is essentially associated with the fact that solar energy, like any form of energy from the natural sources, is not coming when we need it, but when the sun is there. And therefore, storage is, as we will discuss, I believe, tomorrow by Jack Steinberger, an important asset in order to obtain a solution which will ensure that the society can work on sun. Let me also point out to you that there's an example that the surface of Saudi Arabia is an example of where how important the sun could be. Saudi Arabia energy consumption made out of oil and natural gas corresponds to 1/1000th of the surface of Saudi Arabia covered in solar panels. It seems to me that this is something possible and can be realized provided the proper effort has been launched. Mm. The second problem is nuclear. Now, the nuclear of today is essentially based on some results, some premises which are associated with the Cold War. And there are three important questions, in my view, which have to be solved. The science must solve if we want to have plenty of nuclear energy available to everybody if we may need it. One of them is a question of the waste. The amount of waste produced by today's nuclear energy is much too large. It lasts much too long. There are methods and solutions which allow one to solve the question of the waste, either by new reactions based on thorium or based on depleted uranium, or by burning the radioactive waste essentially with incinerator. The second important problem is the connection between the proliferation problem, the connection within nuclear power and the question of nuclear bomb. The fact that some countries may develop some mechanism whereby one can move from a peaceful solution to a risky, dangerous development of nuclear weapon. And the third question is availability of uranium-235. There is no more uranium-235 on Earth than there is oil or natural gas today. Therefore, any new form of nuclear power will need necessarily to use a different fuel. And different fuels are possible. As I said, fusion is a possibility, but it's a very remote one. There's a much easier, closer solution, which is one of breeding either uranium or, most importantly, thorium. The advantage of thorium is that it allows oneself to use essentially something in which the connection between nuclear power and nuclear energy is totally dissociated. You cannot build a bomb with thorium. Mm. Let me add one more point, John, just to conclude, to indicate how powerful the new development in nuclear energy could be if provided by a real scientific and technological input. For instance, to produce 1 gigawatt, electric gigawatt, for 1 year, you need to produce 200 tons of natural uranium. 200 tons of natural uranium are needed in order to run a standard power reactor for 1 year, 1 gigawatt power. 1 gigawatt per 1 year equal 200 tons. With thorium, you can obtain the same result with 1 ton. So 1 ton of thorium burnt will produce the same amount of energy than the quantity of energy which is produced by 200 tons of uranium, natural uranium. Second point is thorium is a very abundant source of energy. Thorium is as abundant as lead. And therefore, it would be possible in the future years to come to a solution to a nuclear power which will be compatible with all natural requirements that mankind requires to have, namely a short lifetime of waste, safe use of a tool which cannot be diverted in the wrong way, and most importantly, plenty of energy for many centuries to come. The amount of thorium and natural uranium-238 available are such that the separation between renewable and non-renewable is academic. There's no reason to call it non-renewable, an object which can run for thousands of years and many times the energy which we use today.
Mm. No, thank you very much, because in a sense you were providing even two silver bullets. On the one hand, concentrated solar power, which is more or less ready to be explored and exhausted, and the second, the thorium path. Now, let's dwell on the nuclear thing a little bit before going to the solar option. I'd like to invite the panelists to the left. Professor Deisenhofer, would you see it in a similar way as Carlo Rubbia sees it?
Sure. The only thing I would like to ask him is, could you explain what needs to be done to implement a thorium-based nuclear energy production, and why does it not exist yet?
But you have not more than an hour or so to answer the question.
No, I don't. I would try to answer your question in a very, straightforward way. I think that we need much more research and development. I mean, unthinkable ideas have been the strength which have brought us to science and technology. Curiosity and development of solutions are the important questions. We should realize that the bottle is not half empty, it's half full. And therefore, we have to find new solutions. Now, in the case of nuclear, since the last 30, 40 years, after the development of very distinguished physicists like Wigner, like Fermi, like Trillard, all other people which have come up with the fundamental ideas which have made the nuclear physics of the last century to be what it was, and she was perfectly adequate in the conditions which were those at the time. If we could have more physicists to come into this and develop this kind of solution in an open mind, pushed by curiosity, I think the situation will be much better. I think the situation is that while in some fields of, for instance, modern electronics, you develop 15-20% of the R&D money into research of better ways, the amount of money which is now developed in the energy domain to change the energy pattern is extremely small. I think today the amount of real research and development in the energy domain is somewhere between the situation we use in tobacco industry and in the industry of drinkable liquids, 0.01%. Now, this kind of small amount of invention into the developing real new solutions, in my view, is the real key which has to be solved. We have to break the situation in which new development can be done with a sufficient amount of research and development being invested into that, such that we can change things. Nothing can be changed in any field unless you invest in R&D. And the amount of R&D development, honestly, in true energy situation is extremely small, and in my view, has to be fundamentally changed. Mm-hmm. We have a political determination, but the industrial world is not realizing that the change is necessary in this field. Yeah.
I think we should come back to that at the end of the debate. Is the investment in R&D, in particular in the energy field, really sufficient? But you see, there's a lot of money being invested in nuclear fusion, for example. And I would like to ask Professor Steinberger, maybe you would like to address this. Do we need a sort of switch of research money from the nuclear fusion thing to thorium, for example? I mean, Martin Rees, president of the Royal Society, says in the crisis we are in, we need, in a sense, something like an Apollo project on energy and climate. Would you see the switch to thorium research the right thing to do?
I'm afraid you've asked the wrong person for two reasons. One,
okay.
I hear so badly now that I don't know your question
entirely. Oh, yeah.
Second, I'm very skeptical about nuclear fusion. I don't really know what you asked about nuclear fusion. I'll say a few words, but maybe you can find someone who knows more about it.
Let's go on.
In 1955, when I was a young professor at Columbia University, there was Edward Teller. Who here doesn't know the name Edward Teller?
Oh my God. Troublemaker.
We know.
Who's one of the fathers of the fusion bomb. Of the fusion bomb. He gave us a seminar, and he promised nuclear fusion energy in 10 years. That was in 1955. And when I see projects like the Inter project, which I don't know enough about, then for me, it's impossible to see how this can be a practical source of energy in any foreseeable future. So if I want to plan some kind of getting away from the use of fossil fuels now, I don't really see how to use any plan which is based on nuclear fusion. Hopefully someday it will come along, but who knows when. So I think we should focus on other things. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do research on nuclear fusion, but I don't think we should expect that nuclear fusion will solve our problems now.
No, thank you very much. In fact, a lot of money is still being invested. So I'll pass the question to Professor Osharov, who is willing, I guess, to address it. In a sense, would you think that thorium-based sort of nuclear fission would be something like the ultimate renewable energy source?
Well, it's interesting. I think the problem with conventional nuclear energy is always, certainly in the United States, has been one that the public do not trust it. Now, I think we have quite a bit of experience with uranium reactors, and with very few exceptions, I think they have proven to be remarkably safe. I don't know whether we could switch to another technology without at least exciting the concerns of the public that really have to go along with this, which is to say that I think it is a great step toward the solution, but in fact I think it has a lot of political ramifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question is, of course, do we need it at all in a sense? I think it's a brilliant plan, which was, in a sense, outlined by Carlo Rubbia. The question is, do we have time enough, first of all, to develop it? And the second is, don't we have a more robust solution? And I think it would be really interesting to dwell a little bit on the solar, concentrated solar, solar thermal or photovoltaics here, because there have been plans now that if we just go to the deserts of the world, the Sonora Desert in the United States or the Gobi Desert near Beijing or to the Sahara, in principle, there's plenty of room. There's no competition with food production, for example, to provide the world with enough energy. So why isn't it pursued? Why isn't it implemented? Maybe I ask you directly about it.
Okay, well, I mean, I've heard Professor Rubbia talk about his vision of converting the Sahara Desert into an energy farm. And in principle, it looks very good. I think if you worry at all about terrorism, I think it has lots of problems. Disrupting the transmission of energy to Europe, I don't know how hard or easy it is to destroy it. My personal feeling is I would prefer seeing a bunch of separated sources that are perhaps closer to the end consumer. I was impressed with how many solar cells are on roofs throughout Germany. But as everyone knows, Germany is at a relatively high latitude, and it's probably not the best place to do that. And that sort of argues for a Sahara-type solution to the problem. Mm. Certainly in the United States, I think we can do, at least for California, we can do quite well in Nevada. That doesn't work on the East Coast of the United States.
Mm-hmm. So, Professor Chava, don't you think that solar is an interesting option, in particular because the sun shines sun shines for free in the end?
Well, the solar energy is a fine source of energy, but it's too diffuse. So therefore, you need two big areas and it's too costly. If I go back 20 years ago, somebody calculated, I don't know if it's true today or not, that for a solar cell to regain the energy it took to make it, take 20 years. And people don't want to talk about these things.
That's not true anymore.
So it takes 10 years.
No, two years.
Another thing I like to say when I remember it here is that in the United States, we have coal for another 500 years. We have shale oil in Colorado, which is equivalent to all the oil in Saudi Arabia. So there's no limit here if you are willing to do the CO2 things. And if you look at climate, In a historical sense, ice ages has happened, I forget exactly the number, for four or five times every like 100,000 years. And now we are right on the level where it's supposed to happen again. We are 10,000 years into a stable temperature. And when the ice age comes, the temperature falls 8 degrees. So maybe we should pollute more than we do to prevent that. And finally, I like to say that here we discuss the global warming and stuff, but we don't know what is the correct temperature. Will be a miracle if the correct temperature for the world is the temperature we have today. Clearly, that is not true. Maybe we'll be better off 2 degrees warmer. Maybe we'll be better off 2 degrees colder. I don't know. But what I do know, this is not the correct temperature.
Okay, no temperature is the correct one, of course, but if you allow me to make a sort of climate scientist or nonlinear dynamicist...
The level of the water is an important question.
Yeah, right, precisely.
Level of the sea.
I mean, first of all, just a little bit of evidence on this. Over the next 40,000 years, we do not expect any ice age because you can precisely calculate, I mean, the orbital parameters, why we go into an ice age, the so-called Milankovitch cycle. So we are pretty safe, but it will not... The planet will not cool down, so we don't need to put extra CO2 where. That's the one thing. The other thing is, Carlo just said, sea level rise. I mean, another little bit of evidence. In principle, we know that just from geological measurements, no models involved, but 1 degree global warming means about 20 meters sea level rise. There's an almost perfect linear fit, so you can go back in history, can look forward, of course, and you see that, you know, the European target climate protection confined global warming to 2 degrees only above pre-industrial level means in the end 40 meters sea level rise. We don't know how fast it will happen. It can take 1,000 years, but it can happen also within 300 years. But this is just about the background. But I'd like to come
may
back.
May I interrupt for a second? I looked at I have a Norwegian friend who dealt with Greenland. And it turned out that above 1,500 meters, the ice on Greenland have increasing. On the coastline, it decreases. Those are the pictures you see, but they measure the height of the ice inland on Greenland and has increased for the last 10 years by maybe 2 meters. So there's more ice on Greenland now than there were at the beginning of this period. And also,
a quick answer that is, of course, well understood, because if the temperatures get warmer, you have more snow precipitation inland, but while on the marches, you go above the 0 degrees Celsius and when you have melting, but the overall mass balance is clearly negative here. I'd like to dwell on the solar energy a little bit. Professor von Klitzing, I mean, again, concentrated solar, bringing it from the deserts to Europe, for example, that would be one option, a sort of large-scale project. But also, as Professor Osherov said, there could be distributed solutions. If you have solar cells on the roofs of African villages, this cannot be formed into a weapon and doing terrorism with it. So would you think the photovoltaic solar thermal is the basic solution for the future?
But first of all, we need political stabilities. And I think nobody in Europe would like to depend on certain countries in Africa. And
we depend on oil. We depend on gas. Why not depending on solar?
Okay, but to decide big investments, okay, we have to accept oil. But to invest now in these countries, you need some stable solution. And you need some global agreement that really industry will invest with money in the Sahara. It could be a solution, but the storage of energy is still an open question. Distribution is always fantastic. So we need some agreement to arrange the infrastructure for the distribution of the energy.
We don't have to start with the Sahara. We can start with Spain. We can start with Italy. We can start with Greece, with Cyprus, all countries which are perfectly legitimate from sunshine. As you know, those are the countries where the oranges are blossoming, as you say, Mr. Goethe was saying many years ago. And this is the place where you can start.
No, they are starting already in Spain and support solar energy.
Absolutely.
Definitely, perhaps too much. Sometimes financial support from the government is bigger than necessary to drive research.
I'd like to have another opinion on that, because you did this order of magnitude calculations. So, Professor Michel, what's your take on the solar option?
Of course, we have a number of different solar options. We didn't mention solar thermic devices so far, where you simply use mirrors, right, and you focus them on an oil. You heat the oil up to 400 degrees, and you make steam and make electricity.
Correct.
This is also 15% of energy, and it has the advantage then you can use the oil, the heat of the oil, all through the night. So you are not dependent anymore on the sunlight.
Mm.
Well, it's also, we also have the ideas that you have these huge tents where you have a big chimney 1 kilometer high, and then the air gets hot and it goes up and it drives the turbine. And it's all, but there, I think the efficiency at the end is not very clear. There have been some demonstration plans, but still one has to consider this option. But if you compare here, say, Lindau with Sahara, then it's only a factor of two. The sun here in Lindau, to compare to the Sahara, is a factor of two.
That's true.
So we still have a good chance to produce lots of solar energy here. And we in Germany, we could get all our electricity by covering 6,000 square kilometers with photovoltaic cells. And this area we have, I think, on the roofs, we can partly put it. My idea is also good to have the highways covered. So you have the highway, a layer of roof of silicon cells on the highways. So the highways would be protected from wind and would be less traffic jams, and we would have reduced the highways for harvesting energy. Mm. And we can do it in Germany. We don't need the energy from Spain.
No, that's a brilliant idea. We could sell the highways to the energy companies, for example, to run them by private capital. Why not? Before we go, give the audience a chance. You have, I think, provided lots and lots of questions. Thank you very much. So we will extend the session till 3 o'clock. No, that's a joke. We won't do that. Don't be afraid. I'd like to touch just upon one thing that has been mentioned many times. That's carbon capture and sequestration. So the idea, we will have to burn fossil fuels, or at least in Saudi Arabia. By the way, there's a very perverse story to be told about Saudi Arabia here. They are selling oil, of course, at a very high price, so $140 a barrel and so on. For the money, they import coal, actually, because it's much cheaper, and use it in their power plants. It's a crazy thing. And they ignore the solar option altogether. So it's, I think, in a sense, the least efficient way to use energy. And also, there's not much hope that something will dramatically happen. But of course, if one would use coal and gas and even biomass, and would sequester the carbon, so you would separate it when you burn it and put it underground, more or less. A lot of people think about it, and in China and India, this idea is very popular. So would you think this is an interesting option, a part of a portfolio of solutions?
Certainly the idea is, well, I don't think one would want to burn it. There are these other processes, powdered coal and water heated to high temperature. I think that the problem, the fear in my mind, and I think, again, in the public's mind, is whether or not these containers of high pressure CO2 are likely to leak. But the other possibility, of course, is to put it, dissolve it in deep sea aquifers. And then you have to ask the additional question, how stable are those aquifers? So I think, you know, if we have to generate CO2 by burning of coal, which is really what we're talking about, I think. I think we certainly would like to put the CO2 somewhere, but I would prefer seeing a solution that didn't involve using coal. And I think that is the biggest political problem, discouraging nations from burning coal. It's the worst thing we could do.
And that is very difficult because the coal price is, of course, much lower than gas and oil, and that we'll be like that. By the way, just because this is an encounter with the young generation, this question of whether sequestration really works of CO2 is one of the big research questions, absolutely. So both in terms of environmental issues, if you put it into deep sea, for example, or in deep aquifers, but also whether this sequestration works at sufficient efficiency rates at all, because if you burn much more coal in order to produce the same amount of energy, it would be a problem. Now, since I would like to have a final round of opinions on the panel, we should probably switch over to, and my colleague, Pocatrica, is now a terrible task because he has piles of questions here, but I'd like to ask to read out a few of them. So these were your questions, and let's see whether this distinguished panel is able to provide a decent answer.
Yeah, thank you very much. We have got very, very many questions. Thank you very much for them. But of course, I can read only very few of them. I would like to come back a little bit to the general statements or general questions of every one of us. And I just read, can we be sure that mankind causes a climate change? Or could it be a normal fluctuation? I think it's one of the questions which everyone raises, and we should say something about that. Are we really sure?
Let me say something then, because...
Please.
There's something called the Small Ice Age in Europe. And I forget, for 200 years, around 1600, the climate became much colder. And nobody knows why. And no climate model can tell you why. And the fact is that the Earth is not in a stable circle around the sun. The axis changes, Jupiter out there disturbing the planet and so on. And all sorts of things can happen. And I think that the chance that the global warming is anthropogenic is not very large. It may be, but it may also not be. And the first day here, we heard the man from Sweden give a wonderful talk about the real problem in the world, where the people are really poor, and so on. And I think the much better way of spending the money on that than to spending the money trying to prevent something we can't prevent anyway.
No, I think this has to be seriously considered. I have now Carlo Rupp here and Professor Osherov to answer. Just before, since I'm a member of the IPCC, you're right, and the questioner, so to speak, is right. This is not mathematics, it's physics, chemistry, biology, geology, so you can never be absolutely sure. I mean, there is no apodictic way of answering the question. That's why the IPCC gave a sort of very profound probability analysis. So probability density functions were drawn up for almost everything. And the probability was estimated that humankind is seriously interfering with the atmosphere was put larger than 90%. Now you could say we still have 10% safety here, but if you would go to the airport today and the pilot would lean at the gangway, would tell you we will have a crash with at least 90% probability, you will probably would not go on board unless you are a fool. So I think it's a very high probability. But let's ask Professor Rupia now and Professor Osherov.
Yes, well, I think that those people which think the anthropogenic changes are not for today, neither for tomorrow, they should consider the extraordinary situation which this planet is going on today. As I said at the beginning, we are, every decade, we multiply the people on Earth by a factor of a billion. 10% of all the people which ever lived in the history of mankind are alive today. I mean, as I said, when I was a child, the energy consumption of the planet was 1/16th of what it is today. All these arguments, to me, indicate that the effect that anthropogenic changes are an important future situation for mankind to worry about. It seems to be absolutely out of the question. It must be impossible to say that we can continue to go on without anthropogenic changes when we are doubling the population of mankind every 50 years or so. I mean, under those conditions, not to realize that in this type of exploding situation from the point of view of mankind, we can say the planet is one thing and we are the other. It seems to be utter nonsense. This is my own point of view on the logical, on the sense, on the reasonable point of view. Now, in detail, when we come back to the fact, is IPCC right or wrong, and so forth and so on, these are all questions which always be discussed. We'll always have problems. There will always be discussion with probability distribution. But the fact that we are in front of a novelty of a major nature that involves the whole mankind and it has to be solved urgently by using scientific knowledge and scientific information at every possible level available in order to protect the future of the planet, it seems to me it's absolutely a must of future generation. I think we will get away without it, but the young people in this room will have to worry about it, and they better worry as soon as they can.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to say that I think there is very strong correlation with the integrated production of CO2 in our atmosphere and the rise in ocean surface temperatures, for instance. And one may say, well, that over the last 150 years or longer is some funny aberration of our atmosphere, but it seems unlikely. The CO2 level in our atmosphere, we've tracked that back, I think, a million years now. Typically, before the next ice age, it peaks at about 280 to 300 parts per million. We are now close to, if not over, 400 parts per million. And the projections for the next 50 years are that we will actually have to work very hard to keep it below 500 parts per million. These are actual facts. Whether the CO2 level is directly causing the rise in temperature, I think, is slightly unclear, but in fact, I think the 90% that you heard is a number which was not derived by some very obscure calculations. I think there is a lot of data behind it. One can do these calculations.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. So we'll go to the next question, if you are able to
do sure.
So.
Of course, there were a lot of questions concerning nuclear power, solar energy. I think we had mentioned that already quite a bit. But energy saving is also a discussion which also comes up. And the question here, what fraction of our current daily energy turnover could or should be saved without disrupting the life-supporting systems like food provision, healthcare, etc. in our modern industry?
So, Professor Michel, Professor Deisenhofer, would you be prepared to make a sort of out-of-the-blue response to that?
It's difficult to make an accurate prediction, of course, an accurate recommendation, but it's pretty clear so far. It wasn't mentioned that the best way of saving carbon dioxide would be to improve the efficiency of our electricity generators. And nowadays we are a little bit above 30%, but the most modern technology goes up to 50%. And if we really can do that, we save lots of carbon dioxide. Another point which was not addressed here is, of course, the heating problem. Because we here in Germany, in Northern Europe, North America, we spend quite a lot of energy for heating. And so getting better insulations of the houses we can already build zero energy houses, so which don't need any heating energy. And if we have a stronger trend towards that internationally, and not only thinly isolated houses, I have to complain about the U.S. mainly, where they have these very thin wooden houses. we would save lots of energy, and we could reduce our carbon dioxide emissions by at least by 50-60%. Would be my estimate.
Professor Deisenhofer, would you think there is a lot of sort of low-hanging fruits for saving energy?
Yes, very much so. Living in America. this is especially obvious because, first of all, we drive two large cars. Our houses are not insulated as they should, at least the older ones. The whole infrastructure was basically developed without efficient use of energy in mind. And so there is an enormous potential in that in the country of USA. It will take a while because if you go to a handyman or a contractor and say, I want an energy efficient house, they look at you and most of them will not really know what you're talking about, or even though the technologies are all there,
It takes a while to educate the workforce to let this penetrate throughout the infrastructure of society so that the average citizen can take advantage of these improvements. And I think it's now very clear to everybody that energy efficiency in traffic, in mobility needs to be improved. And there are encouraging signs, but they came only after the price of gasoline was considered too high, even though it's maybe only half of what it's here in this country. So it seems as if people react only to basically violent force, in that case, high prices. And but clearly the potential is enormous in North America.
I'd like to extend this question in a sense or push the ball to Professor Chaver, because if I recall it right, you set out as an engineer, and there is this problem of high loss grid in the United States, for example. So simply by transporting electric energy, you lose a lot of energy and money in the end. So this infrastructure has to be renewed anyway. Wouldn't you see this as a win-win option to build a low-loss grid?
You talk about conserving energy? That we'll be talking
about? I'm talking about transporting energy by alternative current infrastructure, for example. There is a lot of loss of energy simply by transporting it from A to B, really, and it has never been renewed in the United States over the last 40 years.
I don't know much about that, but I think that's a very small part of the 10%. Transport loss of what we use. So I don't think that's very important.
10% electricity.
Those are 10%, that's a small part still.
Okay. Okay. Numbers okay. are numbers, of course.
10% of a big number.
It's 10% of a very big number, but nevertheless, it's a small part of it. So it's a singularity, maybe. Professor von Klitzing, how do you think about, energy saving? I recall when you gave a talk at, I think it was at the Deutsche Physikalische Gesellschaft, when you said, when you sort of discovered the von Klitzing constant, so to speak, You were asked by some neighbors and so on, what is it good for? Can you save energy with that? And you had to deny it.
Okay, but there should be always a priority to save energy, but this will not solve the global problem. We should not say, okay, don't save you because you cannot solve the problem. This should be really the priority first.
Okay, allow me to say that I think it is correct that we must reduce our energy consumption, and we can do it by a very large amount. I'm talking about us, the minority of people which live with high-level conditions. But let me tell you what is important are discrepancies between some kind of country and some others. And, for instance, let me give you an example. The amount of electricity which each year is used by Norway, you said Norway, I'm going to use Norway, I got the number here, is 15,000 kilowatts per hour. 15 kilowatts hour per person, 15,000 kilowatts hour per person is the average electricity consumption of Norway. In Tanzania, it's 100 kilowatts per hour, per year, per person. And the second point is that the 1.6 billion people on Earth do not have electricity. And without electricity, you cannot do anything which has to do with normal standard development of activity. Without electricity, you cannot compute, you cannot calculate, you cannot make a business, you're totally isolated with the system. This huge number of people which have very little energy are representing, in my view, a much bigger problem than the fact us starving and slimming a little bit, which we can. But remember, as I said, 90 million people per year means a new Germany is created elsewhere every year. And therefore, we could go to bring the German electricity energy consumption to zero in a year. The rest of the world will have taken over. So therefore, I think the problem is that if we have to do it, and we must do it, the reason is there are other people which do need more energy in order to live in a more decent way, and the overall result of the planet will be a growth of energy. Indeed, the energy has been growing 2% per year in the last 150 years, and it will continue to grow that way in the future because the number of needy will take off, will be less and less, hopefully, and they will need energy as a major element in order to proceed into a better life.
I have to defend Norway here. All this electricity is produced by renewable energy, water power.
Most of it, yeah, but yes, through hydroelectricity, correct, in particular. Norway is in a very good state because you have the renewable energy and you can export the oil, actually. We have to go to the next question.
Yeah, I think due to the time, the statement here, which I would like to read, of course, scientific discussions like that is one side. The opinion of the public and the media, mm-hmm, the other side. So I should put up a last question to my mind, which brings that together. And the young scientist here has put it up in this way. How can we scientists make sure that public and the political leaders can make decisions based on the right information concerning the ecological and economical cost of each technology? So this brings them together, I think, science on the one side, press, media, and the public on the other side. I think this is a very important thing to bring all these three together.
Mm. Yeah, but it's also about the economic costs.
And economic costs, of course. It's a very related question.
It's about society's venture capital, if you like, because you have to take risks when you come up. Professor Steinberger, would you like to respond? Could you hear the question?
I heard the question to some extent. And what I would like to say is it's a good question.
Yeah. That's the reason I brought
it up. Thank you very much.
Yeah. The question, it's so good that you can't, that nobody can really directly answer it.
I mean, here on this table, you've heard opinions which didn't agree, and we're all claiming to be scientists. So to what extent political leaders can believe us is not obvious. Mm-hmm.
I think the part of the problem is that when political leaders, in fact, don't believe us, they will make decisions which are political decisions. I mean, I think an example is the mandating ethanol in our gasoline is a political decision. It is not based on any energy considerations.
I think that's a very telling example. Professor
Michel? I was going to say nearly the same because, in the political system, politicians have to be re-elected. So they are serving the people who voted for them. And if these people are from Bavaria, then of course then they act in favor of the Bavarians. And two examples for me are here. First, of course, we have this support for biomass in Germany is mainly due to Bavarian minister. And also what astonished me very much, they supported the skiing industry in Bavaria by simply not putting value-added tax onto using ski lifts. So this is, and this also, of course, an idea that politicians simply act in order to get re-elected, and this they don't observe our advice for that reason.
At least we are fairly deaf, at least on one ear. It's difficult. I think we have to conclude more or less. Last question, or
maybe make the last round.
Yeah, I think we should
sum it up. And
actually, I'd like to ask you two questions, and you can just pick which one you want to answer. In a sense, it is the first one is clearly about, but pick one, please. The first one is simply about, since we have this state of crisis, at least the energy crisis, I think nobody can debate. We need probably a transformation of our modern industrial metabolism at a planetary scale. So is science really able to communicate sufficiently with the decision makers in business and political system? Is there a way to improve that? Not just by having more money, research money, but communication. So that's the one thing. I mean, scientists will never speak with one voice, and that's very good so, but you have to provide, in a sense, the distribution of the evidence, and that's very complex in general. So are we able to communicate But, and the second is because this is a meeting of young people, an encounter of young people with Nobel laureates. Would you think that in the next decades, the Nobel Prizes will be won in the field of energy, climate, sustainability, biomass, things like that? So the Einsteins of the 21st century will come from that field? So just a quick answer, Professor Deisenhofer, would you like to start?
Well, I don't know about the Nobel Prize.
a tiny little bit, you know about
it. I have the feeling that there is no magic bullet. So we should not wait for a discovery that is perhaps coming. We have to act on our current possibilities. And so it would not be good to wait for an event that could be worth a Nobel Prize. So I think the situation is urgent to make the decision whether we want to do something or we want to do nothing. That is the basic decision. And I hope it will be it will come in favor of doing something, even though. I'm not very optimistic that this will be possible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You are next, Professor Cheddar. We just go around the table now.
My turn?
Yeah, please.
In my opinion, the Nobel Prize in global warming and such has already been given last year by Gore, who got the Nobel Prize for global warming and whatnot. And I hate to say something bad about Norway, but in this case, I sharply disagree with that price.
Okay. Okay. Of course, fortunately, Al Gore is not a scientist. So, Professor von Klitzing.
Okay. If you speak to Nobel Prize winners, very often they say, oh, something surprise was found, or they're not unexpected things. And if somebody finds somebody to directly transform sun energy to hydrogen, some very efficient way, this will be a Nobel Prize, I think. Mm-hmm. But nature didn't succeed in very, very successful in this way. But you never know. I think this would be fantastic if we have some solution directly sun energy to some very efficient way, hydrogen. Mm-hmm. This will. As mentioned, so the priority will be we need something to use the sun directly, and the nuclear energy has to bridge something at least. And in Germany, we have the strange situation that we have to shut down nuclear energy power plants, which are still working for political reasons. And if one could use the money which the industry can save by this to put it in research, I think this would be a solution for everyone.
It's an interesting one. And regarding your miraculous solution, I mean, sun energy directly in hydrogen, there is some hope because nature didn't invent a transistor either. Mm-hmm. So we can probably invent things that have not been seen under the sun so far. Carlo.
Well, I simply a joke to make. I believe that there is no magic bullet, as you say, as far as the energy is concerned. It's a major problem, but it's not one of these things which you, having a overnight idea, you can solve in a brilliant way. Still, I would like to hear the next prize in economics. Somebody to explain what's going on with the price of oil, why the price of oil and the natural gases and things like this go so fast. I think if I were in the economics business, I would worry very much to know what are the real reasons for this. And that will make a lot of help to everybody of us. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting option. Please, you are next, Professor.
Well, I think I know the answer to that, and that is that the short-term demand-supply curve for energy has always been nearly vertical, and I think you know that as well. Hmm. Now, where the money is going, that's a different issue, because it's very complicated. We have all of these people that are holding futures in oil, and that's been typically designed to stabilize prices, and it's certainly not working right now. But getting back to the bigger issues, I think, what we as scientists can do, I think a lot of the solutions are nearly in hand. They are generally engineering solutions. They're not science solutions. I think we understand the processes of how photovoltaic cells work. The issues are learning to make them with high efficiency at low cost. Those are not scientific solutions. Those are engineering solutions.
Correct.
But I think at the same time, all of the solutions that we will need are in fact impacting our lives, and they are therefore political solutions. I'm a member of Scientists and Engineers for Change, and I dare say, I think it was the last time I was here in Lindau, I gave a talk on global warming and the fact that the Bush administration was simply not serving a leadership role in doing anything about it. And afterward, someone from the Department of Energy came up and told me, how dare I say those terrible things about our president? And I don't know if that person is here in this room right now, but in fact, I will stand by what I said. So. Which is to say, I think that at some level, although we're scientists, we understand these problems, and I think we have to play a political role.
Professor Steinberger?
I have no comment.
No. Yeah, that was a very... Okay. So you are the last.
I very much agree with what Professor Osherov said, and I think we have all the technology and engineering is present. We just have to use it and to convince the politicians. But I'm skeptical that we can do it on a worldwide basis, because there certainly will be countries benefiting from the global warming, like Siberia, Northern Canada. But there may be big danger that countries like India will heat up too much and will really suffer quite a lot. I'm convinced that we have to do everything to stop global warming, but we don't need new Nobel Prizes for that. We have all the technology available.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, but okay. So I think we are more or less on time, and I think it has been a very interesting and a very deep discussion in certain aspects. I thank you all very much for piling up really lots and lots of questions. Maybe we should produce a book out of that. But it would be really interesting. Yeah. And thanks a lot for your attention and for your patience. And let's give the panelists a big hand.